I feel like we're at a point similar to what informatics was years ago
Exactly.
when you did that, where we should start to reach out, like you said, to leadership in pathology and ABMS and start
100%.
the planning process for a board certification in AI. I think that's really needed at this point, especially where
No,
things.
you're 100% right. I think something like that that could, I mean, it could be driven through pathology, but because AB Path maybe gives the board certification, but it could accept others in there. Because if you remember, and I'm sure you do, when informatics first came out, initially, then there was an appetite for, and actually, I think most, chief medical information officers nowadays, they're encouraged to have an informatics board, if you see the job listings. And so, when in the beginning, when people were looking for CMIOs, that was not really a requirement or even something that people brought up. But obviously now it's becoming more and more so of not just a nice to have, but strongly recommended or a mandate. And same thing will be true with more and more systems having people in leadership groups in AI-driven processes within health systems. And we already have chief AI officers with for several, health systems. And I think that is the next wave after the CMIO one, which is our chief AI officers that are basically. And so this could be a way for, objectively assessing qualifications for people who may want to tackle into those things, where it would accept people from internal medicine, ER, surgery, any field in medicine that would then enable that person, he or she, who could then become and take on that role, but in a way that's assessed properly through an organizing body like ABMS.
Well, hello and welcome to the podcast of the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine. And it's really a pleasure today to have Hooman Rashidi on our podcast. He's the Associate Dean of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine and a professor and endowed chair at University of Pittsburgh Department of Pathology. And has had such a illustrious career in applying artificial intelligence to medicine, but even more important to me and our listeners is to medical education. And Hooman, let's hear the journey of how you went from just focusing on the MD piece to integrating AI into everything you do and everything you teach. Let's hear your story of how you got here.
Yeah, thanks, Mel. Thank you for the invite, and it's a pleasure being here with you all. I have to say my journey was not a direct journey, as you know. I started off, before medical school in the bioinformatics, machine learning world, before any of this was popular about 30 some years ago in San Diego. And then initially, when I switched over to medicine, I was very naive. I thought I could come into medicine and change things with integration of what I've known from my other world. And I don't think most people were receptive to what we wanted to bring to the table. And not until about 10 years ago where things changed, when AI was being increasingly, especially with predictive analytics stuff, being increasingly used within various health systems. And that's when I would say most of my journey started about 10 years ago, which was, at University of California, Davis, where I was the director of AI for the health system. And we were basically working to improve efficiency, diagnostic accuracy, so on and so forth with sepsis prediction, acute kidney injury prediction, cancer prediction, so on and so forth. And so that was, I think that journey basically started in the traditional non-generative predictive analytics world. And then from there, as you know, I went on to Cleveland Clinic to set up their AI center there. And then I handed it off to some of my old mentees and then joined Pitt in UPMC as overseeing the division of informatics and computational pathology, and also our AI center, computational pathology and AI center of excellence. And so it's been a kind of a wild journey, but I'm actually excited about it. I think there is a lot of awesome opportunities that we can now tackle with AI. But my number one goal, quite frank, currently at Pitt, has been, besides bringing out kind of latest greatest tools and do great research, but equally making sure that the education arm and democratizing AI literacy becomes one of our top priorities, as you know.
Right, and that's really where you and I align, because what we're doing through the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine, through our educational efforts, really is perfectly aligning what you're doing at the University of Pittsburgh. And so really happy that we connected. I have found that Pittsburgh has become a real hub for great faculty like yourself. It's really amazing the centers that are coming out of your university, and like the collaborative efforts that are going on there. So it's really high on my radar. I constantly am coming across faculty from Pittsburgh that are doing amazing things, and I think at least once a week we're currently meeting with someone from the University of Pittsburgh in the medical centers. About the AI work that you guys are doing. But what's really exciting for me is what you've done in the medical education piece. A couple of years ago, I initially just joined the AAMC Artificial Intelligence and Medical Education community that's online, and quickly became like a champion of that community. And I started connecting with like-minded individuals like you and I all across the nation that are interested in implementing AI into medical education. So tell us what you've done in that regard over the years, and but even more recently in your efforts in the last year or two.
Yeah, so it's, you mean for education specifically, right? In terms of,
Right, like in the med ed realm. You and I both really push hard to do teaching in the med ed realm. So
100%,
give us some examples of what you're doing
yeah. So
in med ed.
I have to say, some of this that I'm going to tell you were not my ideas. I just ended up, kind of getting on the bandwagon and implementing them, just to be fair and give credit where it's due, because the meta-ed education aspects of AI that I first was, like early on, I was tackling. This was at University of California, Davis, with Dr. Tran's group on the main campus at UC Davis. And that was more for bioengineering students and grad students. It was, it's more for more technical things and, kids that, and students who were more interested in coding and understanding the math and, more technical aspects. And then I realized when I moved to Cleveland Clinic that that was not really what, the masses were looking for. And with some advice from my supervisors, quite frank, where I basically was nudged to create a no-code course for AI, which we deployed in January of 2024 for Cleveland Clinic wide. They have access to it. And then Cleveland Clinic owns obviously that course. And it's a no code. And what I mean by no code is that we basically just want to encourage everyone to come to the table. So because we know most people in clinical medicine just don't want to open up their terminal or learn a whole new computer language, and they just want to, kind of understand concepts and more more about applications than anything else. So that's what we did. The course that we built at Cleveland Clinic was around a no-code framework where you did not require any coding background, software engineering, or machine learning. There was no coding involved at all. It was all just concepts and study design best practices, statistics, so on and so forth. And then to get people super excited so that they feel enabled and engaged. Full disclosure, it was using some of my own AutoMLs that we had developed, like Milo. And Milo, as you know, is an open source framework that people can use and upload on their thing with and just locally run their models because it's not a cloud-based thing. It's just locally runs on your own laptop, on your own computer. And so we enabled our students to be able to use automated machine learning frameworks like Milo, which is just drag and drop, and or other image AutoMLs. And then in the first 30 minutes of the course, the average student would be able to build their own image classifier, for example. So let's say they could build one that could identify them having a mask on or no mask on with their camera. And that would take 5, 10 minutes to build. Or we would give them data sets around diabetic patients, obviously synthetic forms of those data sets. And they would basically build machine learning models that could predict who may have diabetes or not. And so the first 30 minutes of the course was more around, how easy it is nowadays to build the models. But 95% plus of the course was really concentrating on how to do it the right way. So the best practices around study design, statistics and limitations around machine learning, the ethics and bias considerations within machine learning, regulatory aspects, understanding the data frameworks of how to basically make sure that they bring the right data, clean the right data. So really that's what the course concentrated on. And I'm bringing that up is because when I moved to Pitt, my boss, the dean, basically wanted his own version of the Pitt's version of the course rather than bring in the Cleveland Clinic's version. So that's what I've been basically tackling here for the past year, which is, and I started here a little bit over a year ago. And so we're building a whole new course here, again, a no-code course, because I think most people want that. And so that truly enables democratization of AI literacy. And the way we're doing it here is an enhanced version of the one that we built at Cleveland Clinic, which is a lot more interactive. So in addition to having them getting the AutoML access, instead of just being individual 15, 20-minute, video clips that they follow and, do their exercises with, they now will have capabilities of 30 plus interactive applications that they basically tap into, and so that the user is truly engaged and really interacting with the actual concept. So instead of just teaching them what classification is or what anomaly detection is or how large language models work, they actually open up the app and it's basically looks like a website user interface, and they just walk through it in a super easy interactive way. And then they do exercises, they explore their own data sets if they want, then they take quizzes there. And that really engages everyone as and obviously each person learns differently. So some people may want to spend an hour into that app and learn the topic in more detail. Another person might be well versed in that topic and only needs to spend 10 minutes in it. So that also helps make it most efficient from a learning standpoint. So that's what we're engaged in. And as you know, as part of that are kind of, if you will, the textbook or references that we're using, in addition to the six review articles we wrote for the Cleveland Clinic course that are open access. We wrote another new series here as part of United States and Canadian Academy of Pathology's AI Initiative for Modern Pathology. And so that 8-part series, which is a preface and 7 core articles, that is also going to serve as our AI courses' main references. These are the things that the students are going to learn, truly. I hope that gives you a better perspective.
Oh, it really does. So, just for our audience, through this AAMC community, myself and 5 medical student leaders at AMHSA and numerous faculty across the nation. We basically surveyed over the last year and a half
Yeah.
all 200 medical schools in the US to see what were they doing in the regards to AI. And so this is what we learned, and I'll circle back to you. We learned,
Yeah.
first of all, that every school, this was right a year ago, literally, is when we
Yeah.
finished gathering our data. Every school has a committee. That committee deployed some type of AI curriculum this past fall. So this we're now about 1 year. So we've hit the 1 year mark now of deployment of some type of AI curriculum to this
Got it.
year's medical students nationwide. But that everyone did it in a very siloed way,
Yeah.
often secretively. And so instead of there being like a standardized curriculum, each medical school found its expert, like in the case of Pittsburgh, they recruited you to do this. And then a curriculum was deployed, but they all vary. And what I can tell you is the ones that I personally like are what you designed here. Yours is like a top tier one in my view, because it not only has the educational content, but what sets you and some others apart is that interactive nature of being able to actually use various tools, in your case, some open source tools that you make available, to actually not just hear about it in theory and learn the literacy or the definitions, but to actually use it with some real examples. So that's what I absolutely love about the project that you implemented at Pittsburgh. So, and it's yours is so robust, so intense, and is really a good role model for what should happen at all the medical schools. Hopefully, people will take note of your process and how you're doing this and try to replicate it, because I think it's a, you know, learners now want that interactive engagement, almost like the workshop idea of a hands-on experience of actually using
Absolutely.
something, not just hearing about the theory behind it. So that's really a great way to do it. What do you, aside from the curriculum that you have now deployed this year, like many other
Yeah.
schools, what is on the horizon in the next year or two? Are there going to be any new initiatives? I know we've talked about the idea that many medical schools are offering master's programs. You and I have
Yeah.
discussed even maybe like more advanced type of programs or board
Yeah,
certification.
no, that's a great question. So obviously, as you can imagine, this whole new our new curriculum is a Herculean task, because you know, obviously we've already launched our year one phase one AI for all setups, and our elective that I was telling you about, that interactive elective course with those 30 plus you know, separate apps, interactive apps, that should be finished up by the end of the year, so deployed by early next year for all the students. But that being said, our new vice chancellor of education, along with our dean, they're very interested in, you know, exploring ways where our vice chancellor of education, Paul Wallach, says it nicely, where he believes that learners like to have stackable, and I hope I'm saying it correctly, he calls it stackable options. And I like it, by the way he says it. But and what he means by stackable options is meaning that our elective course that we're offering, that serves as the core that they spend 50, 60 hours taking as their elective. And a good subset of students will take that and kind of learn the basics with that elective. And so that they become better stewards of AI when they're trying to assess an AI tool in their own health system, or be in a tumor board and basically be able to objectively assess an AI model's performance, so on and so forth. So that's more of increasing our AI champions within our healthcare space as we're basically tackling this. But his stackable idea is is an ambitious one, but it's a good one, which is that students or learners may want, and this what we're offering, the elective will be beyond the med school and nursing school and dental school. It will also be the UPMC physicians and others. But then some of these learners may want to basically stack their number of learning options. So after they've taken the core, they may want to basically get additional certificates. So they get their certificate for taking our core from the School of Medicine, and then they may say, I want to take a more advanced, thing and get 8 more units through Pitt and get the official certificate from Pitt as well. And they do that. Or we also have partnered up now with one of our other schools within the health sciences, which is called Rehabilitation School, which is SHRS, and they do a lot of the information technology teaching. So they've created a new master's in AI and healthcare, which Pitt will be offering with a no code requirement. So they will. So our and the center would be our elective. So they'll take our elective, get, let's say, 5 units, and then instead of the stackable just being a certificate or maybe a more advanced certificate, from that elective only, they may want to spend a year and get a master's degree. So instead of so we'll have some people who may want to do a master's degree over a year or two. Maybe they're working physicians and they want to do it. Or it might be, students that we recruit firsthand. So Paul wants to set up similar to our MD MPH track to create an MD MS track that's on AI and healthcare as well. Again, a no code approach. Now, for those who want to do a code approach, we already have that at Pitt because, we have a bunch of students. Actually, some of them work with me in our center. Is they already have picked to wanting to get master's degrees or PhD degrees with our embedded frameworks, but they're code-based. So they want to become developers. And this is either within Pitt environment with pre-existing, courses and degree programs that are already there, or it's with like CMU partners that they do a joint Pitt CMU. Set up. So yeah, we have that. I hope that gives you a better perspective.
It does. What I learned in surveying our colleagues across the nation is that the ones that have really robust, strong programs like the one you built, they are offering, in addition to the curriculum that we discussed in detail, the MD, MS in AI and medicine, and then that becomes a 5-year program.
Yeah, that's
That
correct.
there is a trending towards what you guys are doing at the more robust programs that are really, engineering driven and AI driven. So I love that you're doing that. The other thing I just want to throw out that you and I kind of talked about
Yeah.
last time privately is you're a pathologist and you're in the Department of Pathology. At the places I've been, the informatics fellowships have been hosted by the Department of Pathology. That's like they're under the umbrella of pathology.
Yeah.
And you and I kind of played around with the idea that perhaps we should have a board certification in AI that similar to the fellowship in informatics, a fellowship in AI hosted by departments of pathology. Where just like people do a fellowship year in informatics and sit for the informatics board, perhaps we should promote the notion that,
I agree.
aside
I
from a master's
absolutely.
degree, physicians like to do
Yeah.
after residency and a fellowship year. And that, I really think that the next step in this education process for physicians is the fellowship after residency and then a board certification based on the fellowship. So
I
just
love it. I love your idea, Mal. I think you're right. There is a need for it right now. And this is, let's face it, we're kind of like down the same camp of, addressing needs. Because if you remember when clinical informatics first came out, I mean, I remember I was one of the first people who set up our clinical informatics fellowship
Right.
in California. We're one of the first ones, not the first one, but probably in the top 10 or 20 places.
Right.
But because there's a huge need for that. People need to understand clinical informatics. It's an absolute necessity for day-to-day operations of a typical health system. And health systems have you realize that there's an absolute need for this, to bring that up. And so because of that, we over time, clinical informatics basically went through down the ABMS track and became a boarded setup through the, I believe it's officially under the preventive
It is.
medicine arm, but
Absolutely.
with a
Yeah.
partnership with the American Board of Pathology. And so something similar could happen with AI as well. And I totally advocate and agree with you on the fact that I think, and a good example of it is we have, and this is something we will have to kind of bring up to the, American Board of Pathology leadership and see what they feel like. But I would be very surprised if they would not be receptive, because there are centers like ours that have created specifically computational pathology AI fellowships.
Right.
So we have our first fellow. We've already got approval from our own internal folks, and we have a separate non-ACGME accredited fellowship, because obviously it's not a boarded thing right now. That's called computational pathology as a fellowship. And so this computational pathology AI fellowship, or it could just be other departments could do, but for pathology one, this one could qualify for something that would land, at least make it qualify for board certifications. Now, obviously, that's probably has, I mean, I we would have to kind of get guidance from those who are within that space, who are much well, very well versed within what are the requirements around ABMS and others. But I just think, from a societal and, healthcare need, it should be part of our, roadmap of what we're planning.
Right. And I feel like we're at a point similar to what informatics was years ago
Exactly.
when you did that, where we should start to reach out, like you said, to leadership in pathology and ABMS and start
100%.
the planning process for a board certification in AI. I think that's really needed at this point, especially where
No,
things.
you're 100% right. I think something like that could, I mean, it could be driven through pathology, but because AB Path maybe gives the board certification, but it could accept others in there. Because if you remember, and I'm sure you do, when informatics first came out, initially, then there was an appetite for, and actually I think most, chief medical information officers nowadays, they're encouraged to have an informatics board, if you see the job listings. And so, but in the beginning, when people were looking for CMIOs, that was not really a requirement or even something that people brought up. But obviously now it's becoming more and more so of not just, a nice to have, but, strongly recommended or a mandate. And same thing will be true with more and more systems having people in leadership groups in AI-driven processes within health systems. And we already have chief AI officers for several, health systems. And I think that is the next wave after the CMIO one, which is our chief AI officers that are basically. And so this could be a way for, objectively assessing qualifications for people who may want to tackle into those things, where it would accept people from internal medicine, ER, surgery, any field in medicine that would then enable that person, he or she, who could then become and take on that role, but in a way that's assessed properly through an organizing body like ABMS.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned the example of the chief AI officer. About a year ago, New England Journal of Medicine AI wrote kind of a descriptive article about the chief AI officer. And it's so funny you mention it because right before I started this interview with you, I was actually reviewing the list of, there's currently 48 chief AI officers primarily at most of the large academic medical centers. And I'm in contact with all 48 of them. And I was just actually in the midst of reaching out to them as right before meeting with you. So this has gone from a idea to like the norm within 12 months or less. It's really
100%.
exploded. At least all across the nation, the bigger centers now all have it as a standard now part of the C-suite. And so what we're getting at now is, well, we should have, a pathway of having meaningful credentials to take on such a role. And I think a board certification through pathology and ABMS really makes sense, and kind of like doing it the way that I really like the idea of following the similar path that you did when you started informatics for the nation. I think that is a good idea. And there's a lot of crossover. Many of the people who are leaders like yourself in informatics have naturally taken on these roles in AI as well. So I want to just pivot for a moment and see if we could just talk a little bit about digital pathology. So the reason I bring it up is, as you know, there's over 1,000 FDA-approved algorithms for AI, and that about 75% of them are in radiology.
That's right.
But there has been a big movement in recent years to do digital pathology and AI applications with digital pathology. And it's something that I've been really focusing on recently. And a lot of people in pathology that I work with, like yourself, are doing amazing things within this realm of digital pathology and AI. So can you just give us kind of a big picture of what your view is of what's happening with digitization of pathology and
Yeah, of
AI
course.
as it relates to pathology?
And I would say I encourage you to connect with Liron Pantanowitz and Matthew Hanna, who are both here with us. They're actually part of our center. Liron is actually the chair of the department. So
Right. Well,
these guys are
I'm going
leaders
to
within the
interrupt
digital
for a minute. You're
pathology.
going to be happy to know that he's agreed to
Oh,
speak.
perfect. You'll love it.
He's going to speak next year in 2026 at our conference. So thanks
Perfect.
for
Perfect. You'll love
making
it. Yeah, of course.
that
Of course. Yeah,
happen.
so he's probably the world expert in digital pathology. There's a handful of them, like him, Matthew Hanna and Anil Parwani. I would say from a more of a technical person standpoint on AI side, which I live in, I think we've had this concept of digital pathology for over a decade. It's not a new thing. It's just that it didn't really, get any traction for multiple reasons. As opposed to radiology, and just for the audience to better understand this, especially if they're not in pathology, in radiology world, radiology switched over to all digital. So the actual, non-digital X-rays and scans, they went away and everything became digitized, right? So everything they deal with is on a digital standpoint. In pathology, it's a little different, and not a little bit, it's very different, is that the way that we've been creating slides and looking under the microscope, that it's basically really the same way we've been doing it over 100 years. That hasn't changed. So we still have to create slides when somebody gets a biopsy of, let's say, of their cancer, and that biopsy tissue has to be fixed in formalin, has to be cut into a very thin slide, stained, and put on a slide, and then that's when the pathologist looks at it under the microscope to see what they have. And the digital pathology part really comes to in the later stages of this, meaning that The slide is already made. So you still have to make the physical slide. And now you have to scan that physical slide so that you let now somebody to be able to read it, a pathologist to read it, through a digital platform, on their computer. As you can imagine, if you were a pathologist and somebody would come up to you and say, "Hey, I want you to stop using your microscope and from now on use the, digital stuff on your computer." Many of them that were trained only on the microscope, which is still, persists today, most people, they would be, resistant to that because their main question would be, what am I gaining out of this change? If I'm throwing a slide under the microscope and making a call, what would your digitization give to us? And that's where people like Liron and Matthew and others have advocated, which is that ergonomically, it's going to be better for you so you don't mess up your back and your neck while you're working within your digital setup. You could crosstalk to your colleagues a lot easier for a transfer of this stuff, get consultations a lot easier. So there's lots of advantages of being digital, but even with all of those advantages being in place, and I was a big advocate of that forever, most people would not get on board because you also would have to convince your if it, and the other thing that I think a fact that your audience should know is that more than 70% of the pathologists are in some kind of a private practice or private group settings, and they are not or private hospital, and they're not in academia. Only about 10% are in academic medical centers. And so given that the vast majority of the pathologists are practicing in a private setting, what would be the return on investment for their C-suite or the head of the practice to wanting to spend, millions on setting up the infrastructure with additional FTEs to scan for you when their current setup basically was doing the job? And the answer that I have now for that is AI, because without digitization, you would not have AI. And so AI needs digitization, So without a digital slide, there is no AI for you to do. And so now if you are going up to your C-suite and asking for justification of that extra expense to bring on, which is digital pathology framework, they are more receptive to that because they know with AI, in addition to the regular digital pathology, kind of a nice things that it brings by itself, the fact that AI could enhance accuracy, improve workflow, potentially not, if we're also very low on number of pathologists, so there's a workflow shortage, so you're not becoming so dependent on that too, so that more people can do more work, at the same amount of time. So all of these AI will enable, and so I think more people are now becoming more receptive to it, even though they know it's an extra expense, as a thing. So it's more people are now starting to see it as more of an investment, and if you look at it as an investment from a 3 to 10 year plan, it's a win. If you're looking at it as what am I gaining out of it in year one, then you're not really understanding what digital pathology and AI are bringing to the table. The second thing around it is that AI is moving to a whole multimodal, multi-agentic framework, especially multimodals in our world. And for the audience who are not familiar with that, it's just a fancy way of saying we're using different data types. So if I'm bringing my pathology histology data, that image information can be complemented with, let's say, patient's EMR information, with the radiology image information and other types of data formats. And so then that crosstalk of data could give you a better profile of the patient's care and would basically enable our caregivers to not only become more accurate, but also a more efficient workflow health space. So pathology happens to be one of several key players in that space that's coming out as well too. So so it's very important for pathology to become digitized, because otherwise you have a missing link here, and you will not really truly be able to, take multimodal to its full capability, because that's where, you need to combine pathology, radiology, EMR, all of them under the same space if you want to kind of maximize, the biggest bang for your buck, So I hope that gives you a better
Oh,
perspective.
it does. So I was just at ASCO, which is the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, which is a massive conference, the main one for the world. And what we are talking about now is critical here. Like, if we want to really be difference makers in diagnosing and treating cancer super early and essentially getting closer to, like, not just treating it, but curing people of cancer, we have to apply AI to digital pathology and do the multimodal approach that you're talking about. So I really view pathology as like the next frontier, the thing that we all should be working on now, since the radiology piece seems pretty, well figured out and is now being implemented. I think the hard part is, like you said, getting the C-suite of medical centers to
Exactly.
have the ability to do digital pathology so that we can really implement AI in that kind of multimodal way. So I really love how you framed it. It really gets to the point. The one thing that I really learned in going deep in on this is the real barrier is that, and doctors, for the most part, that aren't at your level don't recognize that the barrier is that hospitals don't have the technology. They haven't purchased the technology to digitize pathology like has happened in radiology. So even though we have really robust literature to show that it is amazingly beneficial when you apply AI to digital pathology, we can't actually implement it unless a C-suite leader is willing to buy the digitization
That's
equipment.
very true. That's very true. Now, Mel, I have to say, I totally agree with you. I think that's very true. In our system, we do have, because you also need to deploy it in the right way. So in our system, for example, and this is no credit to me, because when I came here, it was already pre-existing. It was something that Liron Pantenowitz and Anil Perwani put together when they were both here. And that is that they had created a lab here, which was CLIA approved. So government regulatory passed everything. And it was called, it's still called IAL, which is in my division. And IAL stands for Image Analytics Lab. And we have multiple AI tools in this Image Analytics Lab that are part of our clinical practice. So when, and this is both vendor-based or home-brewed ones that we've had. So we, our IAL lab ensures that the validation is proper. It's almost like when you're doing checking for JCO, checklist or CAP checklist. And we do the same thing here. So having a CLIA approved lab that ensures that the AI tools that we're using clinically are validated appropriately. So some of them are vendor based, like when we have with IBEX for prostate cancer prediction. Some of them are home brewed, like our tuberculosis prediction, so on and so forth. And so then these are then, kind of given as assistive, information to our practicing pathologists. So then they use it for their final diagnosis. So it still stays as a human in the loop, and just the pathologists just see it as an added information to their pre-existing part of their workflow. So I'm bringing that up is because our workflow here is, it's very nice in the sense that we have CPACE, our AI center that creates the tools, both pathology and surgery, internal medicine ones, various ways, and then is also able to deploy it, and then that deployment arm can be on the image analytics lab and other setups that we have that could do it. And then, but because also clinical informatics section of pathology is under our division as well, Matthew Hanna, who oversees that, makes sure that it basically can then in the future cross talk with, our Epic framework when it's basically put in, and so on and so forth. So we see it as kind of like a puzzle pieces that need to be put together to make sure that it becomes a seamless process rather than a bunch of silos that are working independent of each other. And at the end of the day, they have a great idea, but it doesn't get implemented clinically well.
I love that from a systems perspective. So it really fits into my final thoughts for the podcast, which is humans' pearls of wisdom for AI and medicine. So forget about what specialty a doctor might be.
Yeah.
Give some pearls of advice to moving into the future. What would you advise
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
physicians
So
that are
I would
AI and
say,
medicine?
yeah. So I would say, first and foremost, I hope everyone has realized that AI is not a fad anymore, that it's going to be part of the fabric of everything we do. It's starting to, I mean, obviously, we haven't even seen the tipping point of it yet, but I would say the biggest pitch for me for the audience would be, really tackle the AI education part. Really get yourself involved in learning about AI, because if you don't, you're gonna be behind. And this space moves so fast. The other reason I think it's very important for us within our space in medicine to be well versed within AI is because most of our non, professional colleagues, friends, and family, they see us as leaders. And I think it's our societal duty to make sure that we're also helping, giving the right advice to our neighbors and loved ones as AI is changing the workflow landscape. So as they're getting prepared, neighbors, loved ones who may have to reskill or upskill themselves, they're going to come up to us and ask for advice. And people do that all the time. I mean, they ask for healthcare advice, they ask for finance advice, even though I'm not qualified for that at all. And yet, so people will come in and say, what should I do with AI? Or even if they don't, it's good for us to kind of like nudge them and let them know so that when that AI tsunami full on hits, even though we're not going to be able to, completely change its, some of its deleterious effects, at least we've minimized its societal impact. And in terms of transition of reskilling, upskilling of, folks into new positions. And that also includes in the healthcare space. Now, in healthcare, I would argue it's even more important, meaning that right now, if you went into a tumor board, within the tumor board, as opposed to 50 years ago, where it was only like a hem-onc doc and maybe a pathologist who are just cross-talking here and there, a typical tumor board now is typically a hem-onc doc, onc surgery, somebody from pathology, radiology, pharmacist, a social worker, make sure that they're compliant with their regimens and whatnot. But the one thing that's missing, even though we're using AI as part of our triage nowadays in healthcare systems, there is nobody who's in that tumor board who knows the limitations, and they probably have heard about the capabilities, but they don't know about the limitations and the shortcomings of some of these AI tools. So we're making decisions in tumor boards and multidisciplinary conferences around decisions that some of these tools have made, but without really having any expertise that's present within these spaces that could actually help drive better care for our patients. So I think as more and more AI tools get implemented, it will be our duty to have a lot more AI champions who are present at these multidisciplinary conferences like Tumor Board that could ultimately help give better patient care to our, the people we serve. So I would say that's the biggest thing. And then the last thing I want to leave people with would be around something that I'm stealing from my friend Jason Rosenstock, and he's the dean of education here. And that is that people ask us, how do I best use AI, specifically generative AI? And our notion here is a very simple one. He has this concept of DVP. It's the mnemonic is DVP. So D for this, and this is for use of generative AI that we tell people how to do within BIT landscape. So D for disclosing, V for verifying, and P for protecting. That's what I'm going to leave you with, which is if you are going to use generative AI, something like ChatGPT for what you're doing, make sure you disclose it to your colleagues and people that you've basically shared the information with, so they don't automatically think that it was your work only. So that you're being very honest about it, and it's okay to use the thing, get an outline, write your information in there, and said that you've disclosed that you've got some help from it. So the first thing is honesty and disclosing. Second one would be around verification. We know these things have hallucinations, or better word would be just errors and confabulations. And given that they make errors, it's very important for us as we use these things to make sure we cross-check their validity. So verifying the information is super important as you do. And finally, protecting, making sure that we don't put up any HIPAA or sensitive information or IP or violating our institutional policies when it's not allowed. So being protective as part of this framework is also very important. So I think if people follow a DVP approach, most bad things would not happen as frequently that they may be happening, you know. So I'll leave you with that. I hope that was helpful.
I love the mnemonic. We all learned medicine that way
That's
back
right.
in the
That's
day,
right.
and it's a
Yeah. That's right.
great framework to move forward into the AI space. Well, Hooman, this was such a great conversation with you
Thank
guys
you so much, Mal. Thank you for the
today,
invite again.
and I'm really looking forward to collaborating with you personally on future
Sure.
med education initiatives. You really are at the forefront, a true leader in all of
Thank
this.
you.
And thanks for all you've done in the past and all you're going to do in the future to advance AI and medicine. So it was great seeing you.
Thanks,
And
Mal. Appreciate it.
okay, bye everyone.
Bye, Mal.
If you enjoyed what you heard here today, consider becoming a member of our professional society by going to www.americancollegeaim.org and click join. Also, don't forget to save the dates. September 19th and 20th, 2025, we'll be having our first ever scientific session at McCormick Place right here in Chicago. Go to our website to register to attend the conference. We hope to see you all live in Chicago, and we look forward to having you tune in to our next podcast on Melvin Monday here on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.